On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For a while last fall, with the Republican thumping in the November election, Vice President Dick Cheney seemed back in the bunker. The most powerful vice president in the history of the Republic looked sidelined. But in the last few weeks, as tensions have risen over Iraq's strategy and the White House has looked almost spoiling for a fight with Iran, Dick Cheney is very much back in the limelight, claiming enormous successes in Iraq, saying the U.S. Congress won't stop us in Iraq. Damaged White House credibility? Hogwash, says the VP, as his own former chief of staff is on trial for perjury. His message to critics? I'm vice president and they're not. Up next, On Point, the superpower VP in winter, Dick Cheney, and his role right now. Joining me today from Washington is Ron Suskind, Pulitzer Prize-winning former senior national affairs writer at The Wall Street Journal. His latest book is The 1% Doctrine, a deep study on Dick Cheney's stamp on national security policy and more. Ron Suskind, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom. Nice to be here.
And with us from Austin, Texas, is Lou DeBose, former editor of the Texas Observer, longtime observer of George W. Bush and the vice president. His latest book is Vice, Dick Cheney and the Hijacking of the American Presidency. Lou DeBose, thanks for joining us from Austin.
Glad to be with you.
Ron, let me go to you first, or really to both of you. It was just last fall, New York Times, David Sanger and Eric Schmidt and many others saying the vice president's influence is on the wane. His power no longer goes unquestioned. Now here we are, sort of crunch time, post-November election on Iraq policy and maybe Iran and war, and the vice president is very much back in the limelight. Ron Suskind, what do you make of that? Does it mean his influence is resurgent or something else?
Well, I was never one that believed, Tom, that the vice president's power had waned. I think there was maybe a little bit of spin in that. They're obviously all very good reporters. But look, Dick Cheney has a pattern of surfacing and submerging at times of his choosing or times of political expediency and convenience for many years. And I think that period last year was a time where he decided to submerge. I don't think his power has diminished at all, in fact. As the president becomes increasingly isolated and fewer so-called honest brokers have access to the president, which I think has been a pattern for the past few years, Cheney's power, in fact, is augmented. Ever more, the decision-making tree here, the loop, is the president and the vice president in a room with the door shut. Condoleezza Rice is overseas on various campaigns, negotiations of modest success in many cases. Stephen Hadley is even less consequential than Condoleezza Rice was in the National Security Advisor's job. There isn't even an Andy Card around anymore. Josh Bolton's a different kind of character. And I think what you find is the vice president and the president essentially are in a team of two making these decisions. And that conversation is one that I'm sure Lou and I both want to get inside of. Maybe history will help us there, but that's the key.
We'll try and do that. Lou DeBose, how do you see it? A conversation of two. 2 years to go, neither man standing for election again. That gives them an awful lot of free rein. The Republicans are making plenty of noise of their own right now. How do you see the vice president's influence right now as President Bush looks at Iraq and Iraq policy, as the president looks across the border at Iran with increasingly bellicose noises? How do you see the VP's stamp, Lou?
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with Ron. I'd like to add the institutional underpinnings of this. You know, you have an office of the vice presidency only recently with, you know, FOIA requests and reporters sneaking about. Are we learning who the staff is? You have an OVP that has really overpowered the office of the president, I think. You know, when we started out, we Texans thought highly of the Iron Triangle of Karen Hughes, Karl Rove, and Joe Alma. Karl's brilliant, but Karen and Joe Alma are pretty middling characters. In the office of the vice president, you had and still have David Addington, who has been involved with Dick Cheney since they served together on the House Intelligence Committee and then in the Iran-Contra Committee. So you have people with a history of institutional historical institution of infighting, bureaucratic infighting in Washington against a president who had limited experience there. So I think that there's an institutional capacity in the office of the vice president. John Turley can grade the lawyers later, but the Attorney General Gonzalez is no match for David Addington. And I think that they're also out, the president is outstaffed and dealing with a vice president who understands how power works.
The vice president with an office far larger than it's been in the past. And Dick Cheney talking a lot in the last couple of weeks. And Washington, in many quarters, kind of responding with paroxysms of, I'm not sure what, frustration. Dick Durbin, as Maureen Dowd pointed out, on the Senate floor, denouncing the vice president as delusional. And then Maureen Dowd, who can wield quite a pen, but she says delusional is far too mild a word to describe Dick Cheney. Delusional doesn't begin to capture the profound, transcendental, one-flew-over daftness of the man. Fighting words when it comes to a VP. He's been talking a lot. Let's listen to just a little bit. Last week, here's the vice president with CNN's Wolf Blitzer. Dick Cheney said the administration is committed to moving ahead with its plan to send more troops to Iraq.
The fact is we can complete the task in Iraq. We're going to do it. We've got Petraeus, General Petraeus, taking over. It is a good strategy. It will work, but we have to have the stomach to finish the task.
What if the Senate passes a resolution saying this is not a good idea? Will that stop you?
It won't stop us, and it would be, I think, detrimental from the standpoint of the troops, as General Petraeus said yesterday.
It won't stop us. Ron Suskind, we'll try and get inside the conversation, but what about the rhetoric here? Dick Cheney siding with Chris Wallace, enormous progress in Iraq, as, of course, we've all seen what we've seen there. Looking at the administration's credibility problems, which seem fairly patent when his own former chief of staff is on trial for perjury, calling all that hogwash. Saying, you heard it here, Congress won't stop us. Asked if he cares about Brent Scowcroft and others, criticism saying, I'm the vice president and they're not. Ron, what do you make of this latest rhetorical sally?
Well, it's getting folks into the mind of Dick Cheney. I've been sort of doing that for a few years, talking to senior advisors, cabinet-level people who sort of walk out of meetings with Cheney stunned in many cases. And it's Dick's world, and you're just a visitor. That's kind of the philosophy. And that goes for Dick Durbin or naysayers, dead-enders, doubters, if you will, throughout the government. Cheney is, in his view, in a conversation with history. That's his view. And the rest of the folks are in a conversation with news cycles. That's Cheney's position. So that he, arming himself with this clarity in his mind, the stuff just bounces off of him, including some of the most sober and responsible advice from folks who have been with Dick Cheney for decades in many cases. Brent Scowcroft, certainly he's known Colin Powell, a guy that I wrote about at one point, Paul O'Neill. This is a small list. The list goes around the block. And that's why what we're finding now is, I think, increasing isolation as Cheney's conversation with history, as he sees it, gets ever deeper and more personal. So he looks at this situation, says, we don't have the stomach for it. That's our problem. He's placing the Iraq campaign in light of World War II, for instance, with 400,000 American men dead. He says, compared to that, what's 3,000 casualties? On the U.S. side. We are in a global struggle for the future of everything that's sacred. This is the Cheney position. And the fact is that we barely have the stomach, in his view, for a very modest sacrifice that we've made up to now. His view, again, is that we've made progress by action. This is the key. Cheney believes in the primacy of action. And he has brought Bush into an embrace of that. It's in Bush's nature anyway to go with his gut, his instinct. But that's really Cheney's architecture. Action is what works here, especially when you have few options. You act. We can't stop the spread of weapons of mass destruction, Cheney says. The key is we need to act and keep our enemies on the defensive. And that cult of action, I call it, continuous action, is one that I think is guiding events and may guide us into other campaigns in Iraq, rather in Iran and elsewhere.
Yes, exactly. As the White House looks across the border at Iran, Maureen Dowdlew saying he assumes, Cheney, that the more people think he's crazy, the saner he must be. He sees himself as a prophet in the wilderness. What about the president, though? George W. Bush, you know him well. The State of the Union address, the president talked about the possibility of failure in Iraq and talked about compromise with Congress. The very next day, Cheney's out with almost a directly contradictory kind of message. How does the president see the VP when he gets up on his high horse with rhetoric that doesn't line up with the president's own?
It's a pattern. Not the first time it's happened. If you go back to the run-up to the war in Iraq, you had Colin Powell and you had the president talking about letting the inspectors do their work on the ground. And several days later, to Powell's astonishment, Cheney goes to the VFW and at their national convention in Tennessee and essentially declares war, undercutting Powell as he frequently did. And I don't know whether he is pushing policy with his speeches, or whether he is actually giving us a better read of the policy decisions that have actually been made inside the White House. But it's a pattern with Dick Cheney to take the more aggressive position among the two, and at times in direct contradiction of the president.
January 14th, here's Vice President Dick Cheney talking with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday about Iran and its neighbors.
Iran's a problem in a much larger sense. They have begun to conduct themselves in ways that have created a great deal of tension throughout the region. If you go and talk with the Gulf states, or if you talk with the Saudis, or if you talk with the Israelis, or the Jordanians, the entire region is worried, partly because of the conduct of Mr. Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, who appears to be a radical, a man who believes in an apocalyptic vision of the future, and who thinks it's imminent.
The VP talking tough on Iran, and that talk has just gotten tougher from the White House since then. Let's go to our listeners, Joe in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Joe.
Hello.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, I tell you what, I just thank God for rock ribs, steel-jawed, scotch-drinking conservatives like Dick Cheney right now to give advice to George Bush. Picture, if you will, the president going it alone with the weight of the world. We're waging World War III. These people aren't to be reasoned with, and I think that, sad as it is and repugnant as it is to a lot of people, brute force is going to be ultimately what's necessary to gain the respect of those that would kill our children and loved ones.
Joe, let me ask you, what do you say to those who say what we need here is not stomach, but more more brains? What do you say, Joe, to those who say this administration, is driving us off a cliff?
Here's what I say. The brains are there. George Bush is stupid and crazy as a fox, okay? Dick Cheney has the guts and the brains. And like Barry Goldwater said, when I needs a PhD, I hires one.
Joe, we've got it in Des Moines. Thanks very much for that. Let's get one more voice in here from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. William, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity to speak, and what a great show. I tend to agree with a lot of what the last caller said, and having been in a much lower level position of executive leadership, no leader brings to the table a complete array of talents. And the best leaders in the world are the ones that can bring in strong people like Dick Cheney. That doesn't necessarily mean that Bush agrees or disagrees with Bush with Cheney on all things. But the last thing you want when you're a leadership position like Bush is in is a bunch of people that are just going to tell you what you want to hear.
And who do you think is the boss in this White House, William?
I really do believe that George Bush is the boss. I truly, honestly believe that. I think he stood up many times and accepted responsibility very clearly and very openly for decisions that have been made.
Let me ask you this. Do you think Dick Cheney has helped put the country in a stronger position than it was in 4 years ago?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question. And one quick point.
Yes.
If you read the number of terrorist attacks that were against American assets for the last 10 or 12 years, I forget the exact number, They came to a screeching halt on 911, and no American asset has been attacked since this administration has been in.
Well, except maybe 150,000 troops in Iraq, but we take your point. William, let me get one more here before we go back to Ron and Lou. Scott's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have to admit I'm a bit aghast at the previous two calls, but my main question is it possible to impeach the vice president? Cheney has been clearly behind arguably the worst foreign policy decisions in the last century, and yet he's essentially unanswerable. If President Bush was impeached, Cheney would be forced out into the light, as it were. But just more to the point, getting directly to what I think is a huge problem in the country, is it possible to impeach the vice president?
So we have a couple saying lift him up, and Scott, you saying let's use the law and take him out. Ron, Lou, I mean, the Democrats promised not to impeach the president, but they did not promise not to impeach the vice president. And you hear that span of views. Ron, what do you make of it? How do you interpret American response to this vice president?
Well, you know, I think that the president and the vice president are a bit hard to separate, which might make it difficult for an impeachment proceeding. But certainly anyone can be removed from office by the will of Congress. What's interesting is the mix of callers, all of them quite thoughtful in their way. Joe and William, the first two, were talking about something that I hear from inside the White House. There's a phrase they use about our enemies, the folks in the Mideast, which is speak to them in a way they can understand. And it's a condescending kind of phrase, but it's one that essentially says force works and force is all that works with these people. I think that we're seeing, however, the limits of that position, of that idea, because it drives us toward the base, if you will, toward a kind of a model that is really all tactics and not much strategy, and frankly, tactics with a very limited shelf life.
Just punch,
and what
punch,
we're finding
punch,
is that it's not worked.
Lou, what do you say about that span of American opinion in response to this VP?
Well, it's interesting because you're talking about a vice president whose numbers hover around 20%. So we've got an interesting sample this morning.
Talk about the base. That's the basement. That's 10 points lower than the president.
That doesn't reflect that. I think the greater concern here is when we talk about the use of force and the force option. I think if you look at Ron's calculations and analysis at the low threshold. At the low threshold that is required to justify preemptive military force. And if you look at a vice president who stood out in 1975 with Richard Ford and Don Rumsfeld on the night that Saigon was evacuated, and at that moment saw the presidency at its lowest point and has spent the rest of his life expanding the presidency, that roll of the dice has now failed in Iraq, which makes Iran the last chance to vindicate his idea of a unitary executive and the use of force effectively. So I think it's a real dangerous equation when you look at those variables.
Ron, you've looked at the 1% solution, Cheney's view on security. Do you see him looking across that border at Iran, Tehran, and saying, George, maybe we should get in there while we've still got 2 years. Let's go to war.
I have no doubt that's the way he views Iran. You know, the 1% doctrine, which is a Cheney construct, which is the heart of the U.S. playbook on foreign policy, says essentially if there's a 1% chance that a rogue state or terrorist group can get their hands on a WMD, we need to treat it as a certainty, not in our analysis of the preponderance of evidence. Cheney dismisses mm-hmm. those things, but in our response. And the fact is, right now, there's well more than a 1% level of evidence, if you will, about Iran and its intentions and certainly the path that Iran is on. Cheney, I'm sure, is sitting there right now saying, how can we embrace action, real action, forceful action in terms of Iran? And that's the discussion that is occurring now and has been occurring for the last few months inside of the White House, driven by Dick Cheney.
And you've got a new aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf and the vice president talking about the Iranian threat. Ron, Lou, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Laura Rosen. She's senior correspondent for the American Prospect, reports on national security and foreign policy. She's been following the Scooter Libby trial, and recently in the Washington Monthly had a piece entitled Cheney's Dead Enders. Laura Rosen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You write about what you call Cheney's state within the state. What is that?
you know, he has loyalists throughout the bureaucracy, and they've been very effective at making end runs around the sort of policy experts inside the federal bureaucracy and allowing Cheney's office to get their way.
But Wolfowitz is gone, Feith is gone, Rumsfeld is gone. Does he still have a state within the state?
Yes, I mean, he doesn't really have a bureaucratic equal or a bureaucratic foil inside the administration. You see with Secretary of State Rice and National Security Advisor Hadley, and even now with the new Defense Secretary Gates, a kind of accommodation of Cheney within the administration that serves to move the whole government's policy closer to Cheney's position.
You call his state within the state, your phrase again, dwindling and beleaguered, but not to be underestimated. Who's carrying water now, effectively?
You can see, I mean, last May, Secretary of State Rice made this stunning announcement that the U.S. would consider joining direct talks with Iran if Iran would agree to suspend uranium enrichment. And in other words, the policy was moving towards possible engagement with Iran. And Cheney's office kind of waited this out, and now you see the policy moving in an entirely different direction towards confrontation. The whole State Department is being dragged along with it. You have, you know, Cheney's daughter was a lead official in the State Department until last summer, with people working for her who were, leading this new Iran-Syria operations group that are running essentially an interagency process for figuring out ways that we can poke at Iran. One of the officials working on that policy group may move over to Cheney's office instead of running it from the National Security Council. It'll be run out of Cheney's office. It'll be very hard for Congress or the press to get insights into what this policy group is working on, very similar to what was happening in advance of the Iraq War.
Let's go to New York City and Vincent. Hi, Vincent. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Ron, I know you. I'm dating Libby. I just wanted to say hi. But
it's old home week. What do you know, Vincent?
My question is this. Like, at this point, how can you really constrain Cheney? Because it doesn't seem that there's any stomach for real impeachment, as people were talking about before. Like, the most the Congress can do is really pass a non-binding resolution. And so, like, at this point, are people just waiting for Bush and Cheney to leave? Because, I mean, they don't really seem to actually want to stop them from continuing these policies.
It's a long time and a lot of potential firepower applied between now and them leaving office. What do you say, Ron Suskin?
Well, it's a good point, Vincent. I think what we're probably looking at over the next 2 years is a series of constitutional crises, to be frank, between the power of the legislature, power of Congress, and the courts to try to prescribe, to rein in executive power. Cheney is armed and ready for this. He has very clear views about the unitary executive, so-called, and the diminishment of executive power over the last 3 decades. I'm not sure what history he's been reading over the last 3 decades. The presidency seems to have been repaired fairly soundly since the mid-70s. In any event, what you're going to find is Cheney moving forward and various parts of government attempting. I don't think they will probably succeed, because the clock is ticking, after all, in reining in the executive and what the executive decides to do on this foreign front. Short of Congress cutting off funding, which is a very, very serious step, especially with 150,000 young Americans in the middle of a peril, there is not a whole lot that can be done. And certainly the courts, as Jonathan Turley, I'm sure, will tell us, are not things that Cheney gives much mind to when it comes to the primacy of action and the need to act.
Lou DeBose, how do you see it? It's now a couple of years since the election. A lot has changed in Iraq since then. 2 more years to go with this VP and president. Cheney saying straight up of Congress, it won't stop us. So, to Vincent's question from New York, can there be any constraint on this duo, this man?
I think that's the big question. I think that's the question that is going to be played out, as Ron described, in a series of confrontations that may rise to the level of constitutional crises. You know, Dick Cheney is the first vice president in the history of the office who had an office in the House of Representatives. There is no constitutional role for the vice president in the House of Representatives. Cheney went over and asked Denny Hastert, who was utterly lacking in institutional patriotism, asked him for an office, and Cheney had an office in the House. He believes in an expanded unitary executive, the likes of which was never envisioned by the founding fathers. I want to return for just a second to Iran, though. After the war, when the war in Iraq was still a success, the Iranians approached the State Department. Going back to what Laura addressed, the Iranians right after the U.S. troops rolled into Baghdad, the Iranians approached the State Department through the Swiss and offered to negotiate. They offered to negotiate on nuclear, on terrorism, on relations with Israel. And the State Department was interested. That initiative was killed by the Vice President of the United States. So you're practicing this muscular diplomacy at the same time through war, and at the same time when you achieve your objective and bring people to the table, you refuse to negotiate. So I think that's what we're looking at in Iran, which is a terrifying prospect.
Still a big power with a lot of power. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Matthew calling from Weymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Matthew. You're on the air.
Good morning, Tom.
Hi.
My question is this. Aside from national security concerns, could there be a purely domestic political argument going on here? Namely, if we can make the American public afraid enough of Iran, then we have to stay in Iraq as long as Iran is perceived as such a threat. So that means the Democrats are put into a box.
But there was already plenty of fear last fall, wasn't there, Matthew? And the Democrats, as the president says, thumped the GOP.
Yep. Well, we'll see. But in the Senate, it's very difficult for Senate Democrats to argue we should reduce or leave Iraq if it sounds as though that will strengthen a hated enemy like Iran.
Right. We've got it. Thanks for that, Laura Rosen. What about it? Fear as a political tool here, paranoid, legitimate concern?
I think that's an excellent point. I think that the administration is using the threat of Iran as an excuse. Blaming Iran's presence in Iraq as an excuse for why things are going so badly in Iraq. And I talked to someone in the administration yesterday who said, you know, is Iran meddling in Iraq? And yes, they are. And the administration is soon going to make a case about precisely what Iran is doing in Iraq. But they said, if Iran totally got out of Iraq altogether, would our problems be solved? And this person said, no. I mean, it's not. But you can see already the administration is almost convincing itself that Iran is the main obstacle to success in Iraq.
Mm. Ron, we've just got half a minute before the break, but how do you see the vice president looking at this? Genuine security threat, political opportunity, both? Are they separable in Dick Cheney's mind?
Well, they're inseparable in the minds of the American public. There's no accountability here. You've got secrecy, intelligence, and action all tied very tightly together. The administration will make claims about Iran and its threat to us directly, and we will be in the same situation because the structure hasn't changed, the same situation we've been in before as to what to believe and not, with a clock ticking.
Lou is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Lou. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
One of your guests mentioned that Vice President Cheney thinks the citizens of this country don't have the guts to make the sacrifice that we need to make to succeed in Iraq.
He said he believes Al-Qaeda believes that and has to be disproved.
Yeah, well, these sacrifices are the lives of American soldiers, and it's well documented that Cheney himself dodged the draft several times to get out of serving in Vietnam.
He had other priorities, he said.
Right. And I think it's sadly ironic that he doesn't mind sacrificing American lives, but when it was his turn to put his life on the line, he thought otherwise.
Lou DeBose, is that the kind of irony that would give the vice president pause?
Not for a moment. As you said, he had other priorities. I mean, Dick Cheney was working in the Nixon White House when he should have been serving in Vietnam. You know, you had four student deferments and a timely pregnancy, and Dick Cheney dodged the bullet on Vietnam. You know, interesting fact though, he was as a Secretary of Defense, that was never really an issue when he was the senior George Bush's Secretary of Defense because of the respect that he paid to the military and the authority with which he made his decisions. He was highly regarded as SecDef when he was Secretary of Defense. He's anathema at the Pentagon now if you talk to generals who are looking at the military being dismantled. a larger issue than his a much larger issue than his avoiding the draft is his leaving the U.S. military terribly impaired at a time that it's desperately needed.
I want to look at the constitutional issues here for a moment, since we've never seen a vice president who has exercised the office in quite this way. Let me turn, if I may, to Denver, Colorado, and Jonathan Turley. He's a law professor at George Washington University, joining us today from Denver. Jonathan Turley, thank you for being with us.
Hello, and hi to Laura, Ron, and Lou.
Great to have you all. Step back with us for a moment and just look at the role that this vice president has made for himself. Does it fit in the constitutional construct that we've had for a couple centuries and more?
I think that many people don't appreciate how unprecedented this role really is. I mean, if you recall, you know, someone like Cactus Jack Garner, who was the vice president to FDR, once referred to this position as not worth a warm bucket of spit. And he was a former speaker.
Cactus Jack, yeah.
Yeah. And even LBJ, when he was vice president, really was not used as much as he should be. In fact, he was kept at arm's distance.
And talk about a power. I mean, he had plenty of engine power.
Yeah, and, you know, the vice presidency was always basically a guy who was holding the hand of the president and waiting for the EKG to go flat.
But that's just precedent. Maybe it doesn't – does the Constitution permit it if you've got one who steps up like Mr. Cheney has?
Well, it definitely permits it. The president can rely on anyone for advice, and certainly the vice president's a natural choice. What is problematic is that – the vice president has created almost feudal estate within the White House. That's something I think Laura has talked about quite eloquently. But constitutionally, it raises serious problems because by removing, and I think this is the purpose, by removing much of this action from the Justice Department and the Department of Defense.
Which action, Jonathan?
Well, it actually ranges from the energy bill to Iraq to Iran to you name it.
Surveillance?
Yeah, a lot of this is coming directly out of Cheney's office. And it not only reflects the fact that he's the center of gravity in the administration, I think that he actually is more of a center of gravity than the president, but it also insulates those decisions and those actions from review. It's much harder for Congress to conduct oversight of the White House than it is for these other agencies.
Because the executive is just shielded by that. It's the executive, after all.
That's right. And in some ways, this administration has been gaming the system. You know, they've been quite clever in finding ways to reduce transparency and to really reduce the role of the legislature. I mean, Cheney's view of the Constitution is almost that it's I think he thinks the Constitution is just Article 2 and executive powers, and the rest of them are just appendages to Article 2. And that really reflects how the administration has been constructed around Cheney's office.
Jonathan, stand by for a moment. I want to take a call from Savannah, Georgia. Robert's on the line. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hey. I love your show.
Thank you, sir.
I believe that Dick Cheney is the most dangerous man since Benedict Arnold, and I think if anything should happen to George W. Bush, this country would be sunk.
Well, why so dangerous? Benedict Arnold, that's a pretty big claim.
Well, I consider myself sort of prescient, and going back to the Crusades, it seems like the whole administration is ignorant of history, and this war really began about 1,000 years ago, almost, with the so-called Christian Crusades.
Robert, you're taking a very, very big view there. We'll try and get our heads around that. I thank you for your call. Let me get one more from Cambridge, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Hi. Good.
I hope we don't get to talk about Dick Cheney's daughter because, you know, that's just a distraction, which they love right now. I'm sure she wants to have a child and she's going to love her baby, and that's wonderful. But
call it a distraction, but the homosexuality issue and gay marriage did have a big political impact. But anyway, to your point,
who cares,
David.
Right now, the question is, how are we going to drive a stake through the heart of this monster? And what I want to know from your folks there is, why has the establishment, people represented by George Bush's father, Ben Skrokoff, Colin Powell, James Baker, why have they been so impotent in the face of this guy? Has he discovered some new political force in the country? I don't know, the force of bogus masculinity.
Dark energy. You know? We'll ask it. Ron Suskind, what do you say?
Well, from the start, the question among that group, David, that you mentioned is, did we not know Dick or did Dick change? That was the debate with the Scowcrofts and the Bakers and the folks around 41, so-called. What you've seen over the past 6-7 years that crowd not being able to assert much authority and then less authority as things move forward. You know, interestingly, Cheney has positioned himself brilliantly, I think, between the two presidents, if you will. And part of the victim of that positioning has been the honest broker, so-called, pragmatist mostly, that surrounded 41, his father. They have very little currency in this administration. I think the Baker-Hamilton Commission is a perfect example of that. That's a 41 old-style pragmatic Republican and Democrat bipartisan kind of group. Look how much power, look how much effect that group had. Zero, frankly. They had some political help that they offered in terms of the election. But after that, people were saying, my goodness, they seem to have ignored the recommendations of the commission. Folks who observed Dick Cheney closely saying, what surprises you about that?
Let's go to Christine in Boston. Hi, Christine. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate all this talk. I hear everything that everyone is saying and agree wholeheartedly. But I'd like to know, how do we get beyond the talk immediately to do something?
Something like what? To do what, Christine? What do you mean?
Well, let our voices be heard immediately.
We've heard voices on this show saying, bravo, Dick Cheney. I hear you talking in another direction. So what kind of action are you seeking?
Non-bravo, Dick Cheney. Non-bravo, Bush. Stop the war. Stop this continuation of killing of soldiers and Iraqi people. Not just our troops, but what about the Iraqi people?
So what's the action path to that? Jonathan Turley, what about it? 2 years is a long time. There's a lot of firepower at Dick Cheney's disposal. He's shown in the past. He's ready to push for its use. Congress right now, not so happy with the direction of the administration, but still kind of, you know, cutting it both ways, resolution against, but probably funding for. Are there reins to be pulled on this vice president and his president?
Well, there's plenty Congress can do. It's remarkable that they haven't done more. I mean, Dick Cheney may be the most unpopular vice president since Spiro Agnew. I mean, it's almost statistically impossible to go lower in the polls than he has been for some time. And Congress, clearly, if you talk to them privately, most of them believe this war can only end badly. It's not that the Shiites and the Sunnis are going to suddenly find a level of brotherly love. But the Democrats aren't prepared to go nose-to-nose, toe-to-toe in a real sense. The framers intentionally divided the authority of conducting what they call foreign entanglements and wars to both Congress and the president. They wanted to create tension. They wanted to give Congress enough authority that they can stop the war. They have that authority. They can also limit it. You know, Congress in the past prevented administrations from going into Angola, Nicaragua, by preventing money from going forward.
But Cheney says they won't stop us.
Well, I'll tell you, the biggest concern that I have is, I think he must be speaking politically. He may believe that constitutionally, but he's wrong. But the biggest concern I have is that they're putting so many carriers and surface vessels near Iran. Mm. If something were to happen, if a single Iranian frigate gets into a problem with one of those vessels in that closed space, the president would have authority, without the approval of Congress, to attack Iran. And if Iran then responded, and they have a rather unhinged president, so I wouldn't be surprised.
Ahmadinejad.
Yeah. Then he could escalate further, and this could go easily on autopilot. I don't think people realize that this is an administration that really believes in inherent authority, and they believe that if anything happens in that closed space, that they can go after Iran, and it'll be some time later before they go to Congress.
In that case, Lou DeBose, in that description, an awful lot rides on the president, George W. Bush. He's sitting right next to Dick Cheney. He talked a little bit more a compromising line in his State of the Union address. Do you see him casting any doubting glances at his mate there? Might the president, you know, put his foot out the door of this car to slow it down, break away or not?
I think if he had, he would have, after Cheney's remarkable performance on Wolf Blitzer. I think that the two work in collaboration. And what Professor Turley is describing in Iran is the creating the precise problem that we now have in Iraq, which is what bewilders and bedevils the Democrats. You're put the Congress into a situation in which it can't lose and it can't win. And I think the Vice President does a great deal of the big thinking in the administration, and I think the White House is outstaffed by the office of the Vice Presidency. You know, you have for a time, and I don't know that it's still going on, you have a Vice President who created his own National Security Council office inside the OVP, the Office of the Vice Presidency. Mm-hmm. They read all the email traffic of the President's National Security Staff. The President's National NSC staff could not read the other way, couldn't read the Vice President's NSC staff. You had White House employees meeting in hallways and talking on phones to avoid email, to avoid the surveillance of a vice president who is just immensely powerful. So I don't see the president slowing him down. I see them working in tandem.
Laura Rosen, you've been following the Scooter Libby trial a bit, former chief of staff to the vice president on trial for perjury. Any chance something may come out of that trial that would lay a finger on the vice president, trim his sails a little?
You know, I mean, there's just this tremendous disconnect between what we're all talking about of the tremendous power of the vice president and his unwillingness to internalize any of the signs that his power should be diminished and he should recognize that. And the Scooter Libby trial, which has all these comical elements of his press aides, you know, complaining that the press never calls them to get their side of the story after Joe Wilson's op-ed appears, you know, attacking the administration's case for war. And so there's these kind of comical elements that show this most powerful office, you know, so petty and so upset by this you know, opinion article. Dick Cheney himself is writing on the margins of Joe Wilson's op-ed. And, you know, there's this huge campaign from that office to try to protect their integrity.
Maybe funny for just a second, but it's deadly serious stuff here. Let me get one more call from Concord, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. You know, this whole situation is so ambiguous. You know, I look at Dick Cheney, a very bright man, and yes, I did vote for the Bush-Cheney ticket.
Mm-hmm.
I saw no alternatives. In my view, but I look at Cheney very much the same way you keep maybe a tough dog in your house for guard duty. I think Bush is although Cheney is willing to maybe go further than you'd like to see him go, I think there's still a leash around him, and I think the control still comes from the top.
So you don't think the dog's calling the shots here?
Well, you know what? I do think that happens sometime, but I think that's because it's allowed to happen, and I think it takes the pressure off the president a little bit. And this is the guy that puts fear into everybody. I noticed that when they went to talk to Cheney about his daughter, I mean, he quickly put the fear of God in all the reports.
You're out of line, Wolf. You're out of line, Wolf.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. And I'll tell you what, that type A personality is just like all of a sudden you get the fear of, you know, you just about wet your pants.
Bottom line with you, Jim, you glad he's there now or not? You voted for him.
Well, I voted for him. You know, I'm not happy with the whole situation. I hate this. I hate the way we went into the war to begin with. I understand that it was nice to give this guy a good boot in the butt, but I never quite understood the connection to the terrorism, even from the get-go.
Jim, we've got it, and we've just got a clip of time here. Ron Suskind, how do you see this playing out? Do you see the vice president actively pushing toward military confrontation with Iran?
There's no doubt that that's in the vice president's lens at this point. And as Jim says, the fact is the codependency, if you will, between the president and the vice president is one of history's great riddles. We'll be arguing about it for a long time. I think the best way to think about it is that Dick Cheney essentially constructs a White House, builds an architecture inside of which George Bush can be George Bush and still be president. He can indulge his instinct, be a man of action, and move forward, especially after 9/11. that gets to the core of how the ship of state essentially is constructed at this point. And I think it leads people to some reasonable fears about where that ship may be heading.
This story by no means over, but we're watching closely. I'm grateful to all of you for being here. Ron Susskind, author of The 1% Doctrine. Ron, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Lou DeBose in Austin, Texas, author of Vice. Lou, great to speak with you again. Thanks for being here.
Good to be with you once again.
Laura Rosen, senior correspondent for The American Prospect. Laura, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University, joining us today from Denver, Colorado. Jonathan Turley, always great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.